Hello, this is Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, October 9th, 2025. The top of the page of the News Gazette has two photos with the caption "Now and Then." Similar angle, same scene, 42 years apart. Michael Smeltzer's photo of Illini football fans rushing the field after last month's win against USC matched the bedlam of beating Michigan in Mike White's finest season. 1983 repeats itself with a new skyline and a new scoreboard. Will it happen again when number one Ohio State visits Saturday? Hall of Fame advice. Former Illini women's basketball coach Teresa Grintz talks to U of I students, including Nyla Robinson, about coaching and leadership at a luncheon Wednesday at Huff Hall. On campus as part of the U of I Athletics Hall of Fame class of 2025, Grintz joined 13 students for a Domino's Pizza lunch after several other stops, including a visit to the News Gazette. 2025 Nobel Prizes. Just a kid whose dream was to come to America for chemistry. It was here as a PhD student in the late 80s where the Cal Berkeley professor who shared the 2025 Nobel Prize in Chemistry learned the meaning of and pleasure of discovery, both personal and scientific, and where Omar Yaghi's peers in the University of Illinois Department of Chemistry learned a thing or two about wunderkinds. Since I didn't go to high school, my age as a graduate student was 20 years, not very much older than the undergraduates, and this led to a more friendly and familiar atmosphere as a TA, said Yaghi. Among more than 2,000 U of I alumni featured on the News Gazette's U of I at 150 and beyond site. It didn't take them long to ask me about where I came from, Jordan. When I told them, many of them thought, to my surprise, that I was a prince of a royal family and that I lived in the desert in a tent with camels and oases. They were somewhat disappointed to learn that I was just a kid whose dream was to come to America for chemistry. On Wednesday, Yaghi, U of I 90, learned that he'd been awarded the top prize in his field, the Nobel, which he'll share with Sumu Kitagawa and Richard Robson. He becomes the U of I's 12th Nobel Prize-winning alum. I have many pleasant memories of places, circumstances, and people of those days when I was at the U of I, Yaghi said. Those experiences stayed with me until today. I look back on those days with a great deal of fondness. Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. Few, if any, photographers have covered more rushing the field moments at Gies Memorial Stadium than Michael Smeltzer. The veteran journalist has seen it play out more times than he can remember, starting in 1983 and most recently when the Illini upset USC on September 27th. If Brett Bielema's team knocks off number one Ohio State on Saturday, he'll have another opportunity to capture the chaos. Smeltzer had fun comparing his similar angle photos of the northern end of the stadium taken after the Michigan win in 83 and the USC thriller 42 years later. The campus skyline from that angle has not changed too much, noting the presence of the Armory, Huff Hall, Illini Tower, Sherman Hall, and Snyder Hall, one of the remaining six-pack dorms. However, both of those angles only show half of the field, which was only half of the story, he said. I believe there were more people on the field after USC than in 1983. Research into gas-trapping molecular structures honored. UI PhD recipient among three scientists to be recognized. Three scientists won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry Wednesday for their development of new molecular structures that can trap vast quantities of gas inside, laying the groundwork to potentially suck greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere or harvest moisture from desert environments. The chairperson of the committee that made the award, Award compared the structures called metal organic frameworks to the seemingly bottomless magical handbag carried by Hermione Granger in the Harry Potter series. Another example might be Mary Poppins' enchanted carpet bag. These containers look small from the outside, but are able to hold surprisingly large quantities within. The committee said Sumu Kitagawa, Richard Robson, and Omar M. Yagi were honored for groundbreaking discoveries that may contribute to solving some of humankind's greatest challenges, from pollution to water scarcity. Robson, 88, is affiliated with the University of Melbourne in Australia, while Kitagawa, 74, is with Japan's Kyoto University. Yagi, 60, who is with the University of California, Berkeley, received his PhD from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign in 1990. The work that won the 2025 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. The chemists worked separately but added to each other's breakthroughs over decades, beginning with Robson's work in the 1980s. The scientists were able to devise stable atomic structures that preserved holes of specific sizes that allowed gas or water to flow in and out. The holes can be customized to match the size of specific molecules that scientists or engineers want to hold in place, such as water, carbon dioxide, or methane. That level of control is quite rare in chemistry, said Kim Jelfs, a computational chemist at Imperial College London. It's really efficient for storing gases. A relatively small amount of the structure, which combines metal nodes and organic rods, somewhat like the interchangeable building pieces in Tinker Toys, creates many organized holes and a huge amount of surface area inside. For instance, Jelfs said, a few grams of molecular organic framework may have as much surface area as a soccer field, all of which can be used to lock gas molecules in place. If you can store toxic gases, said American Chemical Society President Dorothy Phillips, it can help address global challenges. Why the work matters. Today, researchers around the world are exploring possibilities that include some of the frameworks to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere and pollution from industrial sites. Another possibility is to use them to harvest moisture from desert air, perhaps to one day provide clean drinking water in arid environments. Scientists are also investigating using the structures for targeted drug delivery. The idea is to load them with medicine that may be slowly released inside the body. It could be a better way to deliver low doses continually, as with cancer drugs, said David Pugh, a chemist at King's College London. The research could be really, really valuable in many industries, he said, but there are still challenges when you translate that from the lab to the real world. For example, many of the structures store the most gas and liquid in very low temperature, high pressure environments, he said. Today, metal organic frameworks are already being used in some surprising ways, including as part of packaging material to keep fruit fresh over long shipping routes by gradually releasing chemicals that slow down the ripening process. Covering it all, Teacher of the Week, Susan Lemke, 5th grade, Unity East Elementary School, Philo. After working in the social services field for 15 years, Susan Lemke began teaching 5th grade at the Unity East Elementary School in Philo in 2010, and she's been there ever since. After graduating from Eastern Illinois University with a degree in psychology, Shiloh High School graduate Susan Lemke spent 15 years working with families and children in the field of social services in Arizona, Texas, and Illinois. During that time, she gravitated toward teaching, and in 2010, she received her teaching license and began teaching 5th grade at Unity East Elementary School, where she's been ever since. Mrs. Lemke goes above and beyond to support her students every day, Principal Jim Carver said. She fosters a classroom environment built on high expectations, motivating each learner to rise to the challenge and achieve their full potential. Her passion is for teaching strong leadership and dedication to excellence to make her an invaluable member of our school community. I find my work important because I have the opportunity and responsibility not only to guide my students in their academic learning, but also to support who they are becoming as people. Teaching gives me the chance to help kids build confidence, develop resilience, and discover their strengths. I know the lessons we work on today, both academic and personal, will carry them with them far beyond the classroom, and that means a lot to me. I became a teacher because I didn't always plan to be a teacher. I entered the profession in my mid-30s after realizing what I loved most about working with children and families was teaching them the skills they needed to be successful, whatever success looked like for them. I saw how important education and supportive relationships were in people's lives, and I felt that teaching would give me a more direct way to continue that work in a meaningful way. Being in the classroom allows me to combine my love of learning with my passion for encouraging students to reach their full potential. My favorite or most unique lesson that I teach is, I love teaching fifth grade because students are becoming more independent and beginning to find their voice. Since my classroom is self-contained, I get to teach every subject, which allows me to merge lessons and experiences so students can make connections, think from different perspectives, and form their own conclusions. One of my favorite projects in fifth grade is our Living Wax Museum at the end of the year. I love the Wax Museum because at the start of the year, students are so nervous. The Wax Museum is the first thing they ask about, but by the end of the year, they are ready and they accomplish something they never thought they could do. The smiles on their faces and the pride they feel after it's over is something I hope stays with them forever as a reminder that they can do hard things. My most fulfilling moments on the job are when my learning often comes from struggle, and that perseverance makes them stronger and more confident. In fifth grade, academics becomes more challenging, and equally important, helping students learn how to be good learners, developing the skills they will carry into junior high, high school, and beyond. When students learn to trust themselves, rely on themselves, and believe in themselves, I believe there are very few limits to what they can achieve. I believe my role is not to tell them what to do, but to guide them so they can discover that confidence on their own. I keep students engaged by making learning interactive, collaborative, and connected to real life. I bring different subjects together and use a variety of activities and media so every student can find a way to connect. I also find all of my students to hold all of my students to high standards because I know they are capable of great things. When they realize that I truly believe in them, they start to believe in themselves, and that builds not only participation and engagement, but all the confidence they need to grow. Something else I'm passionate about. Other than my family, teaching is my greatest passion. I spend a lot of time inside and outside of the classroom looking for ways to improve my practice and strengthen our school. I am always thinking about how we can do things better, and I often spend my personal time problem solving and planning. It doesn't feel like work when you love what you do. My favorite teacher and subject to study in school was, I am not sure I could name just one favorite teacher. I had many who made a difference in their own way. Some encouraged me to be myself, others pushed me to work harder, and some gave me the tough love I needed to grow. That is part of why I love working at Unity East. I believe it is never just one teacher who makes an impact, but the entire school building, working together with a shared goal of helping students thrive. If I were not a teacher, I would probably be a counselor, helping people recognize their potential and build their resilience. I believe our experiences, both good and bad, shape us, but it is our ability to endure and persevere that creates true strength and wisdom. With that resilience, we have a greater chance of creating the lives that we want. Teaching gives me the opportunity to help my students recognize challenges, embrace struggles, and see obstacles as opportunities to learn. Ex-FBI director pleads not guilty. Defense to request case's dismissal. James Comey pleaded not guilty Wednesday in a criminal case that has highlighted the Justice Department's efforts to target adversaries of President Donald Trump. with lawyers for the former FBI director saying that the plan to argue the prosecution is politically motivated and should be dismissed. The arraignment lasted less than half an hour, but it was nonetheless loaded with historical significance, given that the case has amplified concerns the Justice Department is being weaponized in pursuit of Republican presidents' political enemies and is operating at the behest of an administration determined to seek retribution. Comey's not guilty plea to allegations that he lied to Congress 5 years ago kickstarts a process of legal wrangling that could culminate in a trial months from now at the federal courthouse in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside of Washington. Defense lawyers said they intend to ask that the case be thrown out before trial on grounds that it constitutes a vindictive prosecution, and also plan to challenge the legitimacy of the appointment of the prosecutor who filed the charges just days after Trump hastily appointed her to her position. "It's the honor of my life to represent Mr. Comey in this matter," one of Comey's lawyers, Patrick Fitzgerald, a longtime friend who served with him in President George W. Bush's Justice Department, said in court on Wednesday. The indictment 2 weeks ago followed an extraordinary chain of events that saw the Trump administration effectively force out the prosecutor who had been overseeing the Comey investigation and replace him with Lindsey Halligan, a White House aide who previously served as one of the president's former lawyers but had never served as a federal prosecutor. The president also publicly implored Attorney General Pam Bondi to take action against Comey and other perceived adversaries. Less than a week after being appointed, Halligan rushed to file charges before a legal deadline lapsed, despite warnings from other lawyers in the office that the evidence was insufficient for an indictment. She sat at the prosecution table Wednesday. In a sign of the unusual nature of the case, the two prosecutors who have signed on to handle it are both based in North Carolina and opposed to the elite Eastern District of Virginia, which Halligan now leads. The two-count indictment alleges that Comey misled the Senate Judiciary Committee on September 30, 2020, when he was asked whether he had authorized any associate to serve as an anonymous source to the news media related to investigations of either Trump or 2016 Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton. Comey replied that he stood by earlier testimony that he had not given such authorization. Government shutdown, IRS half its staff to be furloughed. The IRS will furlough nearly half of its workforce on Wednesday as part of the ongoing government shutdown, according to an updated contingency plan posted to its website. Most IRS operations are closed, the agency said in a separate letter to its workers. The news comes after President Donald Trump and Congress failed to strike an agreement to fund federal operations, and the government shutdown has entered its second week with no discernible endgame in sight. The agency's initial lapsed appropriations contingency plan, which provided for the first 5 business days of operation, stated that the department would remain open using Democrats' Inflation Reduction Act funds. Now only 39,870 employees, or 53.6%, will remain working as the shutdown continues. It is unclear which workers will remain on the job. Doreen Greenwald, a president of the National Treasury Employees Union, said in a statement that taxpayers should expect increased wait times, backlogs, and delays implementing tax laws changes as the shutdown continues. Taxpayers around the country will now have a much harder time getting the assistance they need just as they get ready to file their extension returns due next week, she said. Every day these employees are locked out of work is another day of frustration for taxpayers and a growing backlog of work that sits and waits for the shutdown to end. She urged the Trump administration and Congress to reach an agreement that reopens government and restores the services that Americans need and deserve. The notice to workers states that furloughed workers and those remain on the job will receive back pay once the shutdown ends. This is notable since the Republican administration on Tuesday warned of no guaranteed back pay for federal workers affected by a government shutdown. Last week, Trump said roughly 750,000 federal workers nationwide were expected to be furloughed across agencies, with some potentially fired by his administration. Representatives from the IRS, the Treasury, and the White House did not comment on the furlough plans. Lower court denies U.S. Representative Mike Boe's lawsuit versus mail-in voting. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments Wednesday in a case that could decide whether political candidates have the right to challenge Illinois' vote-by-mail law in court. U.S. Representative Mike Boast, a Republican from Murfreesboro, and a pair of Illinois primary delegates for President Donald Trump sued the Illinois State Board of Elections in 2022, arguing that the state's law allowing late-arriving mail-in ballots to be counted up to 14 days after the polls close violates the federal law establishing an election day. Both a lower federal court trial court and a federal appeals court have ruled Boast lacked standing to sue. Republicans at both the state and national level embraced mail-in voting in the 2024 election cycle, after pushing back against it in recent years. The Illinois Republican Party joined the Republican National Committee's Bank Your Vote initiative, which encouraged reliable Republican voters to vote early or by mail so campaigns could focus resources on turning out people who were undecided. The Supreme Court's ruling will focus on whether Boast, in his role as a political candidate, has legal grounds to sue over the state's election law. It will not decide whether Illinois' mail-in voting is constitutional. However, a favorable ruling for Boast by the nation's high court would allow his challenge to proceed at a lower level, opening the door for courts to rule on counting mail-in votes after an election. Justices on the conservative-leaning court hinted Wednesday they could favor Boast. Illinois Solicitor General Jane Notes, defending the case for the State Board of Elections, faced challenging questions from the justices. At one point, Justice Brett Kavanaugh warned Notes that she was giving an argument contrary to a written argument filed with the court. A candidate's right to sue. Boast argues that he has a right to sue because he suffers financial injuries by paying campaign staff for 2 weeks beyond the election to monitor ballot counting. He also argued that his vote total might be diluted if more voters are counted after an election night. As a candidate for office, Boast is directly impacted by election laws, Boast's attorney Paul Clement argued. Everybody would like the elections to be conducted lawfully and in compliance with federal law, including the voters, but the injury is visited more specifically on the candidates, Clement said. A candidate's margin of victory also shouldn't matter, Clement said, arguing that even a candidate who is likely to receive 2% of the vote in a race should still be allowed to challenge election laws that could harm their campaign. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, one of the three liberals on the court, was skeptical. Generally, we have said that suits should be brought by people for whom the harm is concrete in some meaningful way, she said, pointing to candidates who might lose by a thin margin. But Justice Neil Gorsuch said whether or not a candidate can challenge election laws shouldn't be based on their likelihood of success, because some candidates enter a race with no chance to win. Winning elections has not been a problem for Boast. He has represented the 12th Congressional District in Southern Illinois since 2015 and was reelected in 2024 with nearly 75% of the vote. The court also granted a Trump administration attorney's request to argue in favor of Boast on Wednesday. State Board defends mail-in voting law. Notes, the attorney representing the Illinois Elections Board, said Boast's desire to receive more votes that does not give him grounds to sue. She also pointed to Boast's attorneys acknowledging in lower courts that Boast was not likely to lose an election even if he believes the rules diminish how many votes he receives. Notes said the law is designed to regulate voters, not candidates. She also argued that the court has never established a set metric for how close a candidate's race must be for them to challenge an election law and shouldn't use Boast's case to set such a precedent. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, another of the court's liberals, warned that applying a margin of victory or defeat test to whether a candidate can sue might open the door to even more lawsuits challenging election laws. People who've lost the election but they want their margin or defeat to be different, or they might think it have been, and so now have litigation over the counting as a result of that, Jackson said. Notes responded that other parts of the law, such as whether a candidate gets on the ballot or faces other limits on fundraising, should be a better way to decide if a candidate has standing to sue over an election law. Notes argued that one reason Bose shouldn't have standing is because he is an experienced candidate and has personal knowledge of how the law works and which direction late arriving ballots trend. That claim bothered some justices. Are you seriously arguing that whether or not the allegations here are sufficient requires an analysis of the particular background and experience of the candidate who files the complaint? Justice Samuel Alito asked. Justice Elena Kagan said she doesn't want candidates to have to produce polls or prior election results to demonstrate their viability. Notes contended that giving Bost or other candidates standing would harm election authorities. Any self-declared candidate could challenge any election rule that they happen to have a policy disagreement with, even if that rule were entirely harmless, Notes said. And election officials who are tasked with actually running elections should have to divert their time and energy and litigate, you know, these policy-based disputes. The court will likely issue a ruling on the case by June. Champaign County Board officials consider extending carbon sequestration ban. Task force working on related ordinance as extra layer of protection for aquifer. Local officials are considering extending a temporary ban on carbon sequestration activities in Champaign County, despite Governor J.B. Pritzker signing protection for the Mahomet Aquifer into law in August. The County Board's Environmental and Land Use Committee will discuss a proposal to extend the local moratorium by another 6 months at its meeting tonight. Senate Bill 1723, which goes into effect January 1st, prohibits sequestration on any site that overlies, underlies, or passes through a sole source aquifer, such as the Mahomet Aquifer, which provides drinking water to nearly 1 million people in central Illinois, according to Prairie Rivers Network. The law also creates a commission tasked with studying the safety of carbon capture and storage in the Mahomet Aquifer area, with assistance from the University of Illinois and its Prairie Research Institute. This includes studying three recharge areas that were excluded from the bill, said advocates from Protect the Mahomet Aquifer Coalition. Prior to the bill being passed, the Champaign County Board approved a one-year ban on local carbon sequestration activities in January so that local regulations could be developed during that time. The board later voted in March to create a carbon sequestration activities task force to draft this ordinance. The CS task force, led by Dr. Chris Storr, former board member, has not yet completed the work that would add detail to our local requirements within the county that are not addressed in the state law, said ELUC chair and task force member Eric Thorsland. The extension is to allow for the task force to finish the ordinance to see a full board vote. According to a memo from County Planning and Zoning Director John Hall to the ELUC, the task force has made good progress, but the draft ordinance is still being reviewed, and a final version cannot be adopted before the temporary ban expires on January 23, 2026. This has been Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, October 9, 2025. Please stay tuned for Part 2.